A new book about Barack Obama will top the New York Times bestseller list this weekend. It's called The Obama Nation, and it argues that the presumptive Democratic presidential nominee will weaken America militarily and economically because he is a liberal ideologue. The book is getting attention because its author is Jerome Corsi. He was co-author of the 2004 book titled Unfit for Command that attacked John Kerry's war record, the so-called swift voting of the Democratic nominee. Joining us to talk about this new book is NPR's Don Gagne. And Don, there have been anti-Obama books before. Does this one break any new ground?
You know, what this one does is over 304 pages, it's a pretty lengthy book, is tie together in narrative form the kind of criticism we've heard of Obama for a long time from those who don't want to see him in the White House. It purports to be a fact-based look at Obama's life. It says he's unprepared to be president. He's been unscrutinized by the media, that he's even dangerous, that he would make America weaker militarily and economically. But it also, you know, implies that he has, you know, deep and close and ongoing ties to Islam. And it raises questions about the time he spent as a youth in Indonesia. And, you know, we know that Senator Obama is a Christian and has been a long practicing Christian. So there are things in the book that are shaded a certain way that could have easily been fact-checked, but for whatever reason, weren't.
What are some of the other allegations that are wrong?
It claims that Senator Obama, for one, was in the audience at a sermon in 2007 by the Reverend Jeremiah Wright. We all know Reverend Jeremiah Wright so well now for his sermons that became so controversial. This was a particularly incendiary one where he talks about white arrogance. And we know from news stories and other reporting that Senator Obama was not there, that he was in Florida at the time. It states that Senator Obama, who has admitted that he used illegal drugs, some marijuana, some cocaine in high school, it states that he's never told us he stopped using those drugs. So for all we know now, he used them through college, into his career in public life, perhaps even after being elected to the Senate. According to the book. We know for a fact, I've been there many times on the campaign trail when Senator Obama has talked about that period in his life. He has said many times, it's been reported, I've heard it, others have heard it, that he hasn't used any illegal drugs since he was 20 years old. And he's talked to students about that in places like Iowa during the caucuses.
The editor of the imprint that's published this book is Mary Madeline. She's a former Republican operative, and she calls the book scholarship. Does it read as scholarship?
It reads more like a political tract. Let me just give you an example. I'll read you just one paragraph here from the introduction. Dr. Corsi writes, "What I seek to prevent by writing this book is an Obama presidency that would represent nothing more than a repeat of the failed extremist politics that have characterized and plagued Democratic Party presidential politics since the late 1960s. He goes on to write, "With Obama, the leftist political correctness enforced by his campaign has even intervened to prevent anyone from using his middle name, which happens to be Hussein."
What's the response been from the Obama campaign to this book?
The senator himself has not addressed it, but one of his campaign spokesmen, Tommy Vietor, wrote, "This book is nothing but a series of lies that were long ago discredited, written by an individual who was discredited after he wrote a similar book to help George Bush and Dick Cheney get reelected 4 years ago." He, of course, is referring to Unfit for Command, swift boat veterans speak out against John Kerry.
And NPR's Don Gagne, thanks very much.
Thank you.
It's got a snappy title and an author with a reputation for making trouble for Democratic presidential candidates. This weekend, Jerome Corsi's new book, The Obama Nation, will debut as number one on the New York Times bestseller list. It's getting the most publicity, but it's not the only anti-Obama book making its way up the bestseller list. In the world of politics, the number of people who buy these books is probably not as important as the number of people who hear about their sometimes shocking claims. NPR's Lynn Neary reports.
If you say the title of Jerome Corsi's book often enough and quickly enough, the words Obama Nation will easily morph into the word abomination. And that, says Corsi, is no accident.
The play on words is intentional because Obama's radical leftist politics, driven by the cult of personality he's intentionally manufactured, would be an abomination.
Corsi is best known as the co-author of Unfit for Command, Swift Boat Veterans Speak Out Against John Kerry, the book that inflicted serious damage on John Kerry's presidential campaign at just about this time 4 years ago. His new book has already been labeled a political hatchet job by his critics, who charge that it is filled with inaccuracies and falsehoods. Such criticism doesn't bother Corsi, who says the book is based on solid scholarship.
But the book is not written to be an academic book. It's an easy, popular read written for, you know, the normal reader. And as with Unfit for Command, it's written in the context of a political campaign, and it's aimed against the candidate, which is Barack Obama.
I have a name for it now. You know, they're saying you're swift-boating Obama. I call it swift-booking Obama.
Dermot McAvoy is a senior editor who writes about political books for Publishers Weekly. Obama Nation, says McAvoy, is one of a slew of both positive and negative books about Barack Obama that are coming on the market now. But McAvoy says political attack books like Corsi's are aimed at a specific audience.
The one thing you must remember about these books, these are written to the choir, to the true believers of the right wing. This base will buy books. I think conservatives will buy books more to reinforce their beliefs than liberals will.
But buying the book is not the whole point. A book only has to sell in the tens of thousands to be a bestseller. So if a book is to have influence on the election, it has to reach beyond those who actually buy it, much less read it. Margie Ross is president and publisher of Regnery Books, which published the Swift Boat book 4 years ago. And Regnery just released another anti-Obama book, appropriately titled The Case Against Barack Obama by David Ferdoso.
Our philosophy, whenever we publish a book, is that there will be 10 to maybe 100 times as many people who hear about the book compared to the number of people who actually go out and buy the book.
In 2004, the influence of Unfit for Command was greatly heightened by an ad campaign that accompanied the book. But Ross says Regnery positions all their books to get maximum attention in the media.
Our approach and our goal is always to make sure that we use a book as a platform for an author to get out his or her message. And by getting out that message on the media, whether it's TV or radio or print or electronic media, I think that gives us a sort of multiplier effect on whatever the message of the book is.
Paul Waldman of the media watchdog group Media Matters says a powerful conservative machine helps propel books like Obama Nation to the public's attention.
One of the interesting things about this is that the conservatives have such a good system in place to promote these books. This is coming out from a division of Simon & Schuster that is headed up by Mary Madeline, who is a GOP operative very close to Vice President Cheney. Once the book comes out, it's then promoted via conservative book clubs and mailing lists, and usually in these cases there are conservative donors and organizations that buy up thousands of copies in bulk. That helps propel it onto the bestseller list, and then the mainstream media figures that they have to pay attention because it's on the bestseller list.
Ultimately, says Dermot McAvoy, it's the candidate who bears the responsibility for dealing with attack books. And that, he says, is the lesson Barack Obama can learn from John Kerry's response to his swift booking.
The candidate did nothing, you know, and he now claims he had no money, I mean John Kerry, to counteract that. But, I mean, you can counteract it in a lot of ways. And, you know, a smart candidate will not allow this to be manipulated into a corner by this.
Yesterday, the Obama campaign did hit back, releasing Unfit for Publication, a 40-page rebuttal of Obama Nation. Saying Corsi is a bigoted fringe author, the campaign called his book disgusting and false. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
Michael Sokolov is the author of the new book, Warrior Girls, Protecting Our Daughters Against the Injury Epidemic in Women's Sports. And welcome to the program.
Thank you, Madeline.
Well, let's talk about gymnastics first and talk about the age issue. Why would younger be better in terms of competing?
First of all, it's the only sport that I know of that younger is better, certainly in the case of young women in gymnastics. They have a greater strength to weight ratio. You know, they're close to as strong as they're going to be, yet they're very light, which allows them to do all these fantastic acrobatics. And also, and I think that this may be as big a factor, if you're 16 or 15 or 14 or 13, as it's alleged that some of the Chinese girls are, you may not have as much fear of what may happen if some of these moves, some of these jumps, some of these dismounts don't go off as you hope they will.
Well, let's talk about what can happen, because these bodies, they're young bodies, they're small bodies, they're bodies that are still growing. And what kinds of effects can this very rigorous form of sport, of exercise, have on these bodies, especially when you look at them do those dismounts? They land so hard on that mat.
Well, you know, I think that gymnastics is in a category all its own. It is, in some ways, a sport that amounts to the slow or sudden accrual of stress fractures and tendon strains and ligament sprains and broken bones. To my eye, you know, a sort of bizarre sport in that way. They land from pretty high heights with stiff legs, with no support on their feet either. I mean, it's a sport that if you almost wanted to see young athletes injured, you would sort of design gymnastics.
And is that just for the girls, or are the boys affected as well?
I think that gymnastics is a very high injury sport for both boys and girls. I think one difference is that gymnastics at an elite level is not a women's sport, it's a girls' sport. And as women go through puberty, as they add weight, it's not a sport that they generally compete as well in.
What about other sports? Are other sports, do they also confer some injuries to developing bodies?
Well, absolutely. The boys and girls, men and women, are different. They are different physically. They're different athletically. When boys go through puberty, when they move through their teens, they get stronger, often without much effort of their own. Girls do not get appreciably stronger, at least not without a lot of effort, but they do get more flexible. So this combination of flexibility, but not always enough good old-fashioned muscle to keep joints in stable positions, causes a range of injuries in joints and knees and hips, backs, across a range of sports. And that's what we're seeing on soccer fields, on basketball courts, all across America and all across the world. Girls do get injured more. It's not inevitable. There are things we can do about it. The first thing that has to happen is we have to recognize the differences.
You know, I think a lot of us remember over the last few Olympics when Carrie Strug, she was a U.S. gymnast, when she stuck her landing on the vault with a broken ankle. What does that tell you about how girls compete and how they perform even when they have injuries?
It's interesting you ask that. Chelsea Memel in this most recent Olympics has just done the same thing. A U.S. gymnast revealed she competed with a broken ankle. You know, in the NFL, when you have a broken ankle, they put a cast on it. In women's gymnastics, they send you back out there to keep competing. And this may be defensible, I suppose, if you're a 20-year-old woman and this is the choice you make and there are gold medals at stake, there may be monetary rewards at stake. I think the unfortunate thing is that that becomes the ethos for much younger girls who get the idea that, you know, we're indestructible, we have to be tougher, perhaps we have to prove our place, our bona fides on the athletic field by playing through pain. But there are limits, and I think we need to recognize this ethos to play on almost as a risk factor in and of itself.
When girls injure themselves, either in gymnastics, in swimming, or in amateur sports, and they suffer injuries to their bones and or to their joints, are those injuries going to be with them for a lifetime?
Often, yes, they will be with them for a lifetime. We've improved surgeries for certain injuries. We haven't necessarily improved lifelong consequences. An example is the ACL injury, the tear or rupture of the anterior cruciate ligament in the knee, which is a stabilizing ligament. It's a tiny but crucial component. Girls suffer this injury at much higher rates. The surgery gets an athlete back on the field much more quickly than we used to see, allows them to play their sport well again. But the ACL injury involves much greater risks of early onset arthritis. And if you do it again, which happens frequently, happens more frequently to young women, then those risks are even greater.
So, you know, a lot of girls play soccer. A lot of parents like the fact that their girls are competing out there and getting great exercise and learning about getting along with teammates and all sorts of other benefits. What do you say to parents who are listening to this and thinking, am I putting my girl at risk by putting her out there on the soccer field?
I would say a few things. First of all, exercise and fitness and high-level elite sports are not necessarily the same thing. So we do have to understand that there are going to be risks. The higher a girl rises in athletics, or the higher a boy rises in athletics. But we have to mitigate those risks. We protect our children in all kinds of ways, and in many ways we overprotect them. In sports, we tend to do the opposite. We throw our children into sports programs where they play a year-round schedule, where they play one sport to excess and do not cross-train. We do all these things that experts unanimously say are the wrong things to do, yet we want our children to excel, we want them to succeed, we want them to stay in the cohort of go-go teams. And many of these things are exactly what are injuring our kids. One of the things that I say is parents need to come together, they need to bond together, and demand sanity in our sports schedules, because what we're doing right now is manufacturing injuries, and we are particularly manufacturing injuries among young women because of some of these physiological differences.
Michael Sokolov is the author of the new book, Warrior Girls, Protecting Our Daughters Against the Injury Epidemic in Women's Sports. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madeline.
An appeals court has ruled that the son and granddaughter of novelist John Steinbeck do not own the rights to some of the writer's best-known works. Steinbeck's heirs have been fighting over the copyrights for years, and we have more this morning from NPR's Laura Seidel.
Steinbeck's son Thomas and his granddaughter Blake Smile brought a suit in federal court over 4 years ago, alleging that there had been a 30-year conspiracy to deprive them of the rights of their legacy. Steinbeck's estate had been in the hands of his third wife, Elaine, until she died in 2003. The couple were married for 18 years, but never had any children of their own. Steinbeck's blood heirs are fighting over 10 early works that include The Grapes of Wrath and Of Mice and Men. All in all, Stanford law professor Paul Goldstein says there is a lot of money at stake.
We're talking about significant works whose copyright will go well into this century, into 2034, 2032, or thereabouts, and that's a fair chunk of royalties.
The case hinges on an intricate aspect of copyright law that allows artists and their descendants to terminate earlier contracts. In this case, it involves a deal that Elaine Steinbeck made with Penguin Books, which is also a party chasing the lucrative royalties of Steinbeck's books. Steinbeck's blood heirs won the case in a federal district court, but a U.S. Court of Appeals overturned that ruling. Grapes of Wrath, which was published in 1939, remains part of the canon of great American literature. An attorney for Steinbeck's son and granddaughter says they will likely appeal the decision. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
NPR's Morning Edition has been exploring crime novels that tell you something about the cities where they're set. I'm looking at a list of these stories at our website, Nablus, Glasgow, Los Angeles. Sometimes the city itself seems to be the main character, which can be true of the British author Jason Goodwin, who sets murder mysteries in Istanbul, Turkey. Goodwin started as a historian of the Ottoman Empire, which was once ruled from that strategic city. Now he imagines murders taking place more than a century ago when the Ottomans still ruled Istanbul's ancient streets. The residents of that city today include NPR's Ivan Watson. We've been hearing him this week away from his home base, witnessing the conflict in Georgia. But before he left, he let Jason Goodwin show him the city they share.
Jason Goodwin's eyes light up when he steps through a centuries-old archway into the carnival-like atmosphere of Istanbul's Grand Bazaar.
You know, you mix this with the old engravings, the old paintings of what it was like in the 19th century, accounts of it. I mean, it's not that different from what it was like then. You know, it's just a complete emporium. Stuffed with gear, I think. Probably.
Beneath ancient domed roofs decorated with Islamic tilework, crowds of Turks and foreign visitors surge past hundreds of shops. The vendors here sell everything from gold and Caspian Sea caviar to Kashmiri pashminas and knockoff Louis Vuitton bags. It is the perfect scene, Goodwin says, for a murder.
The idea of what would happen if someone was just found dead. You know, imagine this place, this complete sort of, you know, everything pullulating with trade, and suddenly has to freeze. You know, the guy's dead.
Goodwin takes a similar, slightly perverse approach to Istanbul's magnificent call to prayer. At sunset, the haunting chant erupts from the many domed mosques and minarets that make up the striking skyline of this city by the sea. This magical moment inspired a sinister scene in Goodwin's novel, The Snake Stone.
The voice was low and rough, and it came from behind as dusk fell. "Hey, George." It was the hour of the evening prayer, when you could no longer distinguish between a black thread and a white one in ordinary light. George pulled a paring knife from his belt and sliced it through the air as he turned. All over Istanbul, muezzins in their minarets threw back their heads and began to chant. It was a good time to kick a man to death in the street.
The Istanbul Goodwin writes about is not the booming megalopolis of modern-day Turkey. Instead, he imagines Istanbul as it was in the 19th century, when it was the capital of the vast Ottoman Empire. Here is Jason Goodwin reading from the Janissary Tree.
It remained the biggest city in the world. 1,500 years of grandeur, 1,500 years of power, 15 centuries of corruption, coups, and compromises. A city of mosques, churches, synagogues, of markets and emporia, of tradesmen, soldiers, beggars. The city to beat all cities, overcrowded and greedy.
The hero is a soft-spoken palace detective named Yashim. Because of his unusual condition, Yashim happens to be the only person in Istanbul allowed to investigate murders in that most forbidden of places, the Sultan's harem.
With his kind face, grey eyes, dark curls barely touched at 40 by the passage of the years, Yashim was a listener, a quiet questioner, and not entirely a man. Yashim was a eunuch.
Where did the idea come from to have a eunuch as a detective?
He has to be someone who's at a kind of tangent to society. So you want somebody who belongs to the society that he patrols, but is at the same time different and kind of he's from it, but he's not of it. And then there's a practical reason why he's a eunuch, because, you know, I'm dealing with a very traditional, essentially Muslim society in 19th century Istanbul. Well, a eunuch is the only character who can really get around. He can go anywhere.
Many of the places where Yashim's adventures take place exist to this day. Goodwin brings a visitor to this ancient underground cistern where his eunuch detective ends up battling a murderous enemy in cold, dark waters.
We're here down in the Yerebatan cistern, which is the incredible sort of forest of columns underneath one of the main squares outside the old church or mosque of Hagia Sophia. And this is where water was stored in Byzantine times. This is built, I should think, in the 6th century, so it's 1,400 years old.
Just a few minutes' walk from the cistern, Goodwin stops into another of his favorite Istanbul landmarks, the famous Egyptian spice market.
And hot paprika, there's mint, oregano, rose tea, and Turkish saffron.
The shopkeepers here happily display their exotic flavors to passing visitors, much as they probably did more than a century ago, as Goodwin reveals in this passage from the Snake Stone.
Mountains of vividly colored powder rose on every stall, pungent spices gathered from all across the world, from the coasts of India and the mountains of China, from Persia and Arabia and the islands of the South Seas, brought here to this great entrepot of the world's trade by dhow, by karak, by camel train and mule train, over deserts, through wild seas, crossing the passes of legendary mountain ranges, bartered and bought, fought for and pilfered, growing ever more valuable and rare, until, at last, they reached this market on the edge of Europe and vanished into a soup or a dish of rice.
When not solving crimes and chasing murderers down Istanbul's winding streets, Yashim the eunuch detective spends a lot of time cooking. So does the author, Jason Goodwin.
So we're just going to do this, chop up these tomatoes, and we're going to put them into the...
So your character cooks all the time.
Well, he cooks a lot. I mean, he's a eunuch. So there's certain things he doesn't derive quite so much pleasure from as perhaps, our listeners would. there's another reason. I mean, there's a good reason why it's good for him to cook. So in these books, you know, one of the things I'm trying to do is always to give a sense of what this Ottoman world was like. And if you imagine that, well, one of the obvious ways into it is, like, what did it taste like? What did they eat?
Goodwin's recipe today is an Ottoman dish of eggplants, garlic, onions, and lots of olive oil. The Ottoman world tastes delicious. Ivan Watson, NPR News, Istanbul.
And you can find a recipe from Jason Goodwin, as well as an excerpt from The Snake Stone at NPR.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
Now we turn to a pair of new novels set in Asia. The Gift of Rain is a first novel by Tan Tuan Eng, set in his home country of Malaysia. And Mosquito by Roma Tiern takes place in Sri Lanka during the current civil war. Reviewer Alan Chu serves as our guide.
The Gift of Rain opens in present-day Penang, an island off the coast of northern Malaysia. It's a first-person novel told by the half-British, half-Chinese heir to a large trading and commodities company founded by the man's English father. "I've never seen the light of Penang replicated anywhere else in the world," this narrator, a businessman named Philip Hutton, says. "Bright, bringing everything into razor-sharp focus, yet at the same time warm and forgiving, making you want to melt into the walls it shines on. His narrative seems to have the same effect as the light. A visitor arrives at Philip's large island house, and everything begins to shift and change. The visitor is a Japanese woman, dying from the long-term effects of the atomic blast at Hiroshima, and the childhood sweetheart of a Japanese diplomat and Aikido master named Hayato Endo. As Philip turns his mind back toward the past, we meet Endo. In the sweet time before Japan invades Malaysia, the older man becomes young Hutton's teacher, training the boy in Aikido, this yoga of swordplay and body blows. The boy becomes stronger by the day, even as Endo takes on a larger role in his life. When the Japanese invade, Philip's bond with Endo leads him to become a collaborator. How the war he fights within himself plays out against the background of the war spreading across South Asia makes the book an engrossing story of interlocking worlds and times. Another look at this part of the world, and another war, comes in Mosquito, the fiction debut of painter Roma Tiern, a young woman born in Sri Lanka and raised in Britain. Sri Lankan nights, as Tiern depicts them, seem darker than dark. The rain in this novel comes down in torrents. And the civil war, one that still threatens to tear apart the writer's home country, also threatens the main character's souls. In her moody, painterly depiction of the encounter-turned-love affair between a Sri Lankan novelist and his neighbor's daughter, Tiern links her love story to national politics with a vengeance. And as the lovers grow closer, despite the difference in their backgrounds and ages, mad revolutionary warriors and ideologues make plots that will eventually trump the best-laid plans of the innocent and destroy the worldly wise. You feel the desire, the affection, and the menace in these pages, along with the rain and heat. Exotic, yes, both of these novels seem that way to a Western reader, and yet both carry us with a deep familiarity into war and the hot, worrisome weather of life.
Alan Chews teaches writing at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. He reviewed the novels Mosquito and The Gift of Rain.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.